The history of movies in America has all the makings of one heck of a screenplay, an epic tale that began over a century ago. Now, Turner Classic Movies, which has made it a point to televise many of the best films made over those years, has put together a seven-part documentary series called Moguls and Movie Stars, A History of Hollywood, which tells that tale of the magic of movies and the drama of movie making. It began on November 1st and continues throughout this and next month, and I'm very pleased that it brings film historian and TCM host Robert Osborne to our studios today. Welcome back.
Thanks. It's nice to be here. Nice to see you again.
What are we up to now?
Last night premiered the fourth episode, which we repeat tomorrow night. And then next Monday, we have episode 5, and then 2 in December, and then we're finished.
Hope that you'll show them all again
yes,
sometime?
Yes, we will. And we also show them on Saturdays. We're repeating them. You know, it's a big investment for us, in not only in money, but it's enthusiasm and time and all of that. So we certainly will show it. And I think, you know, what's wonderful about it, I think, is it's something that bears seeing a couple of times, because there's a lot of information and also great film clips that we've never seen before.
Now, TCM also shows foreign films. Are there fundamental differences between the philosophy behind Hollywood films and films from elsewhere?
I think so. A lot different, because Hollywood has always been a much more commercial, commercially minded, and also appealing to people all over the world. And most of the foreign films were made for their own separate countries and were many more – well, I can't say that, honestly, that they were more artistically done, because all those countries made a lot of bad movies, like Hollywood made a lot of bad movies, but they didn't get exported. But the ones that we got from foreign countries were much more artistic, usually.
And we've had some pretty great directors in this country, beginning with, I might say, D.W. Griffith.
Yes.
And John Ford,
yes.
Howard Hawks, and
a lot of great ones. And then, of course, Hollywood was also enriched by the problems in Europe in the 30s, because so many of those people that were Jewish left European cinema. I mean, certainly the Germans, like we got Billy Wilder, Ernst Lubitsch, and a lot of those great.
Fritz Lang.
Yeah, Fritz Lang and Korngold, great musicians, and all of that.
Jean-Renoir came.
Yes, and they all went to Hollywood. René Clair from France. Many others, Anatole Litvak, and so it enriched the Hollywood product as well.
You co-host TCM's The Essentials with Alec Baldwin. What's the deciding factor when you're choosing movies that you consider essential? And since you sometimes disagree, I wondered if it's because a historian has a different perspective on what makes for an essential film than an actor might.
Well, I think it does, but I think that's why Alec and I are somewhat of a good combination, because he's looking at films from an actor's standpoint, as well as somebody who's very knowledgeable about film, and I'm looking at it more from a historical perspective. But we do disagree quite often, but most often we agree on them. What's an essential? We had a big disagreement about the 1962 version of Mutiny on the Bounty with Brando, that Alec thinks is an essential film that one should see, and I think the first.
That's because of Brando.
I think the first one, of course, that's what it came down to. But we didn't agree on that at all. I think it's a lovely movie to see, but certainly not essential movie going.
Well, Charles Laughton and Clark
the first
Gable.
One. Yeah, first
that's
one,
quite
definitely.
Extraordinary
yes.
combo.
Yeah.
And Laughton was brilliant.
Yes.
How far back should we go in talking about this? This series begins with 1890, but
well, it actually starts before
the Magic Lanterns.
Yes, it goes back before that, which is wonderful, because one thing that I learned from this that I didn't really know, I think I knew that there were the Millier brothers in France, and there was Edison in Menlo Park and all that. But I tended to think, I think, that somebody invented a projector, and therefore we had movies. And it didn't really come that way. It came in a much softer way than that. It came really starting with that people always have to gather together in one auditorium and share an experience. And they started doing that, you know, with theater, but also with shadow shows. Just having shadows up on a screen, and people would gather to watch that, and it evolved from one thing to another. The thing I think is fascinating when you look, though, at the history of movies, as this documentary series does, is the fact that they started out looking at movies through a slot, Nickelodeons, these little pictures down there flipping through, and then movies moved to these movie houses, and then big movie cathedrals like the Radio City Music Hall and the Roxy here in New York that had some 6,000 seats. And then it got to neighborhood houses and everything. And Then it got so movies started being on television, so that's smaller. And now people are watching movies on iPods. So it's almost we've gone the full cycle.
And so even the movie theaters.
Yes, movie theaters.
They've gotten smaller. Used to be a regular movie theater is now six different theaters.
One of the great things about movies was you'd go to see at the local Bijou or the Paramount, and you'd see Judy Garland, three stories tall, singing, or Marilyn Monroe and Some Like It Hot, three stories tall. And that was the impact of that. And now you're watching them smaller and smaller and smaller.
When Edison and the Lumières were first developing things, does the record indicate that anybody recognized that this was going to become as huge an industry
as it
became?
Well, some of the guys did partially wishful thinking, but also partially because these were guys from Europe, many of these guys that were glove salesmen and everything, that were looking to find a business they could be in this country. And they saw that as something, as a great potential, and they certainly hoped it would be. But I think for a long time, it was stuck with being a novelty. Nobody took it seriously at all.
Was it D.W. Griffith and a few other early directors?
Yes, absolutely. D.W. Griffith was what is now the notorious The Birth of a Nation. You know, made a film in 1915 with a story, and an epic story, and huge scenes. And I think that's when, basically, everybody really recognized this had great potential power to move, also to make a great deal of money. And if it hadn't had the power to make a great deal of money, nobody would have cared how much it moved people.
Well, people were aware that there was money involved because there were patent wars at the beginning.
Absolutely.
And
territorial rights, and everybody was fighting each other. And, you know, it was not an easy business to be in early on because it was like, it was a boom. Everything was like boomtown mentality.
And we're talking about New York and the neighboring environs as the boomtown initially.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you had people, being very upset about what the material was going on the screen and how it was going to ruin people's lives and their eyes and their morals and everything like that. So you had fighting on all directions. And then, of course, in the 40s, late 30s and 40s, once sound was in, it seemed to reach kind of its apex. And it was all kind of just going great. And then came television, and that knocked it for a loop again. And theater divorcement, where movies couldn't be made by a studio that also exhibit them in their own studios, and it knocked everything around.
Well, many people believe that the studio system is what produced the greatest Hollywood films, and when that fell apart, then it was catch as catch can.
I think it's quite true. And also the other thing that happened is that when the studios controlled movies, as they did from the beginning of the movies until the 60s, when that all started to fall apart, the end of the kind of studio era, is they no longer had control of what they were doing. And then the actors became more producers, and they became more in control of what was to be done. And I'm not sure actors are ever the best ones to make decisions about their own careers.
There's also another factor. In the early days, the studios would make one reelers, two reelers. They'd make full-length films. And then in the 30s and 40s, they would make films that were intended to be blockbusters. And then they'd make others that were intended to be the second features.
Right.
Sometimes those second features turned out to be the films we now consider to be
the
greatest works of art. And they saw themselves as cutting across a wide range of product. Today, everybody just wants a blockbuster.
Everybody wants a blockbuster, and they're each making individual movies, not doing a slate of pictures, which is why so many of the movies, when you go to a movie theater today and see the trailers, every movie in the trailer looks like the last one you saw the trailer of. But it used to be, each studio sat down, they'd say, well, we're going to make 75 films this year, and we're going to make, 12 Westerns, we're going to make four musicals, we're going to make one big epic, we're going to do some dramas, we'll do some film noir, we're going to do, an Esther Williams film. I mean, it was a variety of things, and each studio did that. So we as customers got a great variety of movies, but we're not getting that anymore, except on Turner Classic Movies.
Of course. How important was the move to Hollywood?
Well, I think it was very important. It was not so easy on the actors, because you had to then be either a New York theater actor or a Hollywood actor. They didn't have as lucky as people in the English movie theaters or French, because the main, film studios in France were in Paris, where the theater was, and the main theaters in or studios in England were in London, where the theaters were. But that had a big effect on the actors, making a choice, East Coast or West Coast. But it also, you know, had wide open spaces. They got away from a lot of bill collectors by going to California. They had space, and that was the main thing.
It had sunlight.
Sunlight, yeah.
But it also led to the development of a two-tier system. You had theater actors and you had movie actors. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they crossed over, mm-hmm. but in many cases, big stars like John Wayne, it was always movies.
Yes, many, many. And many of the people that left the theater and vowed they would always be in the theater, Marlon Brando being one, once he had his big hit in the movies and Streetcar Named Desire, he never stepped foot on a stage again.
My guest is Robert Osborne, who is not only a film historian, but also the host of a number. You always seem to be there at the end of the movie or the beginning of the movie.
Well, I am.
Explaining.
I'm there at 8, 10, 12, and 2.
And we appreciate it because the stories you tell are always fascinating. He is here to talk about a TCM series called Moguls and Movie Stars, A History of Hollywood, which is being shown on Monday nights on TCM throughout this month and through most of December. And we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Robert Osborne talking about a 7-part series that's being shown on Turner Classic Movies called Moguls and Movie Stars, A History of Hollywood. And I was thinking about a major early film farm, Mack Sennett's Keystone Studios, which had so many brilliant stars, Fatty Arbuckle, Gloria Swanson, Harold Lloyd, Charlie Chaplin. How did he go about gathering such incredible talent?
Sennett was an amazing man. He did have a great eye for talent, always did have. Now, we're not listing all those he tried to develop that didn't turn into anything, but he did have a great eye for talent back then. But, you know, it was a wonderful period then because they were true pioneers. Everything was new. There were no rules. And everybody just, you know, the landscape was just empty and ready for people to fill it up. And it's somewhat that way today, again, I think. The way the movie business is today, there are no rules anymore. I mean, there's no set pattern of releasing anymore. Studios don't have any organization anymore. And everybody's just kind of out there in the playing field. And I think that if you're trying to get in the movie business, this is kind of a great time to get into it.
Sometimes I will see a film and realize that the copyright is 2008 or 2009. It's just being released, which means that that the makers had a hard time getting it out there.
Right.
And you wonder why this film is better than a whole bunch of other films.
Well, I think also there's so many films out there. That's one of the problems is you open the New York Times on a Friday and maybe 15 new films open. And some of them are very intriguing and that you'd like to see, but you're no way are you going to be able to see all of them. There was a time you could really kind of almost keep in touch with everything out there, with few exceptions.
We talked about the studio system as having a lot of positive effects. It also had some problems.
It did.
Some people felt controlled. Chaplin did everything possible to maintain independence. The creation of United Artists by actors who felt like they were being taken advantage of.
Right. And the for years, the negatives were what everybody concentrated on, is how bad the studio system was. You had to be there, and they told you who you're supposed to date, what you were going to do, the films you were going to be in, the parts you were going to play. And if they typecast you in one character at that studio, it was very difficult to get away from that and get anything else. But what people are concentrating on more now, particularly the people that were around at that time that are still around, to see the value of what the studio system did for them. They really didn't have to do anything except be prepared and show up for work and learn their lines. And the studio did everything else for them.
And you say that the early heads of studios were former glove makers, or
right.
like a lot of Jewish businessmen
right.
who kind of created the movie business. Today, most of the studio heads seem to either be lawyers or agents.
That's a problem, too, because those glove salesmen, they were showmen. They really knew how to sell their wares. And they also wanted to build a business that would be there for their sons, their son-in-laws, and be there for years. Today, everybody's in it for that one picture. And the problem is that once movies like Star Wars came along and Dumb and Dumber and made big piles of money, all the bright lawyers from Harvard and Dartmouth and every place else start going to Hollywood, and the studios are now run by people that are businessmen. They're not showmen. And in the old days when you had five major studios and the three minors, every one of those studios except MGM was run by somebody who produced movies. Daryl Zanuck knew how to produce a movie. Jack Warner knew how to produce a movie. Harry Cohn at Columbia Pictures knew how to produce a movie. Louis B. Mayer is the only one who didn't produce movies, but at MGM he had Irving Thalberg who did.
When I was a kid, there were the local theaters were the Arcadia Republic, the Lowe's Commodore. There was the Paramount in Manhattan. There was vertical integration.
Right.
How important was that?
That was terribly important because they knew that the films they made would be shown in those theaters. They didn't know how popular they were going to be, but at least they would have an outlet for those movies. But that all ended in 1948-49 when a law came out that you could not make movies and also have the place in which to show movies that was antitrust and was unfair to independent theater owners.
The many of the studios, as we said, were run by Jewish people. And yet we didn't see many films that were critical of the rise of fascism and Nazism during the 30s.
No, but towards the end of the 30s, while a lot of people in America were still doing business with Germany, films did come out, like Confessions of a Nazi Spy. It came out, I believe, in 1939 from Warner Brothers, and then movies like The Mortal Storm from MGM, all before the before America entered the war.
But I understand that Will Hayes and his office actually tried to keep that to a minimum because they were still concerned about distributing films to
right,
Europe.
Exactly.
And then there was Joe Kennedy's influence.
Yes, and a lot of people didn't want to ever stop doing business with Germany because there was a big that was a big healthy market for Americans. I think the Warner Brothers were actually the first to stop doing any dealings with Germany.
Now, how important was the introduction of – well, we know the introduction of sound was important, but I was wondering how accurate Singin' in the Rain was in depicting that time.
Well, it was not that far off, except it was, of course, a spoofing view of it. But it was not that far off. They had a devil of a time trying to figure out how to – where to hide the microphones. You know, people had to talk into plants and all of that until it was finally discovered how they could do that. But it was not that far off. And, of course – we know of careers that were ruined by sound because the beautiful leading ladies or handsome leading men didn't have voices that
Clara
were.
Clara Bow had a Brooklyn accent.
Yeah. And of course, John Gilbert, except when you see his old movies on TCM, it's not such a bad voice. It's just not quite as mellow like a Gary Cooper voice or a Ronald Coleman voice or one of those great voices. So it kind of ruined his romantic image somewhat.
And we have this situation where people who had been superstars suddenly are has-beens. Hollywood actually dealt with that in a couple of movies like Sunset Boulevard and Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and did it very well, particularly Sunset Boulevard. And that's not just because of silent movies, but I think it's a really interesting take on anybody in any field who's no longer needed, no longer wanted, and kind of sent out to pasture.
Now, one of the films that's often cited as the best ever is Citizen Kane. But wasn't that a financial flop?
Yes, it was. Nobody particularly wanted to see it. But part of that, it certainly didn't have to do with the film, and it got a lot of publicity. A lot of it had to do with when it came out. 1941 was not a time when people were all starting to get involved. We were about to get involved in the war. America was, and there was this horrendous war going on in Europe already. And I think it was a time that everybody was getting so much kind of negative, downbeat war news, nobody really wanted to go see that movie with that topic. They wanted to go see Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland, or they want to see Betty Grable, Bob Hope, something that was going to cheer them up when they went to the movies. Because you have to remember that at that period, people primarily went to movies not to be educated or to see life, real life. Those films did come along, like Grapes of Wrath and others, but they primarily went to the movies to be entertained.
In fact, it's always amusing to think about all of those films that were made during the Depression where people are wearing dinner jackets,
yes,
and tuxedos and going to Mocambo or Latin Quarter.
But that kept people going to see that there were people like they're living. But they also particularly liked the screwball comedies because those were all rich people that were kind of daffy and doing silly things. It made people without anything feel somewhat superior.
Wasn't another reason Citizen Kane didn't do well, the campaign against it, by the Hearst newspaper?
Well, I think it did some damage, but I'm not sure that that would that seemed to me kind of publicity that would be something that might intrigue people and make them want to go see the movie. I think it more had to do the box office had to do more with the subject matter.
We have the Marx Brothers doing exceedingly well with
yes.
their screwball comedies. And today is would have been Harpo Marx's 124th birthday.
Yeah, isn't that great? We were going to do a salute to him, except because we love Harpo Marx and the Marx Brothers on TCM, but we're going to have them, all of their films, on New Year's Eve, because we thought they'd be great fun to spend New Year's Eve with.
Now, you mentioned that TV, as everybody would have guessed, played a major role in affecting Hollywood. Didn't you get your start with Lucille Ball?
I did. How interesting you know that. No, I started out as an actor and had a contract with Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz. She put a contract stable together at the RKO Studios, which was then the Desilu Studios. And she was the one that kind of, I was there for 2 years, and she got to know me. She was fascinated that I was so interested in movie history, because nobody was at that point. There was no nostalgia at all about old movies except for a few of us, you know, wacko movie fans. And she's the one that kind of said, she knew I'd been a journalism major at the University of Washington, and she said, you know, you really love old movies. She said, I think you'd do fine as an actor, but that's not going to make you happy. She said, you're not going to be happy at all. And she said, you love history, and we have enough people acting, we have enough actors, but we don't have enough people writing about the movies. That's what you should do.
We don't have enough time to talk about all the interesting things in this series, but I was thinking about the 1960s. The series ends with 1970. Mm-hmm. At the time of all the political turmoil in this country, movies like Oliver and The Sound of Music were winning Academy Awards. Is this the same sort of thing that we were seeing in the Depression? Where...
Well, I think to a degree it was, sure. People would go and be entertained by those films. And the Oscars, I think that they are somewhat of a popularity contest, but I don't think there's anything so wrong with that, because that's what movies are all about, people going to the movies.
And why did they end it in 1970?
Because that's kind of the end of the studio era, and after that, Hollywood has just kind of gone in all different kind of strange places.
We have a link to TCM series Moguls and Movie Stars and the rest of the schedule on our show page at WNYC.org. And as we said, this will be running through December what?
December 7th, I believe.
December 7th?
No, I'm sorry. It's a 6th and 7th episodes, so I don't have the exact last date.
Well, I think it's December 13th, which will be an unlucky day, because we won't have any more of these films to see. My great thanks to Robert Osborne for coming by and talking about it.
Thanks for your time and your interest.
It.